Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What happens when a 9-year-old Syrian boy washes ashore the beach of a Greek island? Omar El-Akkad will be here to discuss his new novel, What Strange Paradise. Just how complicit has Facebook's leadership been in some of the social media giant's biggest scandals? Shira Frenkel and Cecilia Kang join us to talk about their new book, An Ugly Truth. Alexander Alter will be here with the latest in publishing news. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's July 30th. I'm Pamela Paul. Omar El-Akkad joins us now from just outside Portland, Oregon. His latest novel is called What Strange Paradise. Omar, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are in Portland now. I believe that the United States is your fourth country of residence. Stop me if I'm missing something, but you were born in Egypt, lived in Qatar and Canada, and now in the United States?
That's right. Yeah, I've been a guest on someone else's land since I was 5 years old.
How has that influenced you as a writer? I mean, it seems pretty clearly evident in both this novel, What Strange Paradise, and in your debut novel, American War. But maybe you can talk a little bit more about that.
I think it shows up in almost everything I write in a number of ways. One of them is that a lot of my characters have to deal with the sense of being unanchored, both in American War and What Strange Paradise. That's kind of one of the defining character traits. Is a sense of not being able to look at a particular part of the world or even a particular set of stories and be able to say, this is mine. So that's certainly a theme that runs through a lot of what I write. But also it puts me in a position where I just by temperament, I don't really care all that much about the nation state as an entity. I don't care too much about borders, hard lines between places, which was obvious from the first novel where I have a map at the beginning of the book that tears these things apart. So certainly it plays into almost everything I write.
Well, let's talk about that first novel for a moment before we go on to What Strange Paradise. The American War imagined a future Second American Civil War breaking out in the year 2074. Explain the premise of that book.
A very long time ago, I was watching this I don't remember if it was on CNN or one of the other news networks, but it was a segment with a talking head, a foreign affairs expert, and the interview was taking place the day after a set of protests in Afghanistan. Local villagers were protesting against the U.S. military presence, and the question that was put to this gentleman was something like, why do they hate us so much? And as part of his answer, he noted that sometimes the U.S. special forces have to go into these villages and conduct nighttime raids looking for insurgents. And that sometimes when they do this, they will ransack the houses or hold the women and children at gunpoint. And then he very helpfully added, and you know, in Afghan culture, that sort of thing is considered very offensive. And I thought, you know, name me one culture on earth that wouldn't consider this offensive. And that's when I started thinking about taking the defining hallmarks of these conflicts that happened very far away from the United States and recasting them as close to home as I could. And I couldn't think of anything closer to home than a civil war where you're fighting yourself. So that was the premise around which American War coalesced. And I thought it would be read that way. I thought it would be read as another people's story superimposed on the most powerful nation on earth. And instead it comes out 4 months into the Trump administration and it's very much read as an attempt at prophecy and a very American story. So It's been a very strange relationship between what I intended and how that book has largely been read.
I remember some author once told me, and I think a lot of writers have had this experience, where someone came up to him and said, you know, I loved that book so much. It was a story of revenge, and those kinds of stories appeal to me. And the novelist said, revenge? Like, that was a story about redemption. What are you talking about? I mean, did you have this odd feeling of everyone thinks my book is about X, but my intention was Y?
So, for reasons that are still somewhat unclear to me, at one point the folks at Knopf decided to send me this document that was a collection of indie bookseller reactions to American War. And not all of them were positive. They were very honest. I'm glad to have had this document, but it was strange when it showed up in my inbox. But anyway, I'm looking through it.
I was going to say, I feel like it must have been emailed to the wrong person. Like they thought they were sending it to someone else on your team or something.
It might be. I will just take a second on a tangent to shout out all of the people in publishing who do Herculean work to keep bad news away from writers. That is such a huge part of keeping us very fragile people from breaking down completely. This was an interesting document to have because at one point there was a blurb from a bookseller in Texas, and it was something like, you know, American War shows us why a second civil war would be brutal and bloody and why we need to have one. And I thought, really? That's what you got from this book? You know, this thing that I thought was so obviously an anti-war book turned out to have been read in the exact opposite way. So at first, that used to give me a kind of psychological whiplash, and I've become much more comfortable with it as I've seen it happen more often. It's nice to know that these things, you know, you write these books and you kind of hope the point is for them to outlive you. The point is to sort of for them to be on a library shelf somewhere long after you're gone. It's nice to know that they're going to have many lives, even if some of these lives make very little sense to you.
It's interesting that when talking about the inspiration for American War, you cited this instance of seeing reporting around the war on television, but you were also a war correspondent and you were in Afghanistan, right?
I was, yeah, in 2007 and then again in 2009.
What was that like? And did that align? I mean, did you see that kind of thing going on when you were there as a journalist?
The first time I showed up, I was young. I'd read way too much Hemingway. I had this just delusional idea of the war correspondent as superhero and, you know, all that stuff that you realize is fantasy very quickly. I remember I showed up and my first stop was in Kandahar. I was in the NATO airfield in Kandahar, which is, at the time anyway, was like a small city. I think it was like 25,000 people or something. I was leaving the base, and the way the base is structured is that there's an inner wire and an outer wire, and the inner wire defends the base proper, and the outer wire is right on the highway, so it's sort of the interface between the outside world and the base. And the nature of it is that if there's ever an attack, if there's ever a car bomb or anything like that, it's going to hit the outer wire. Well, lo and behold, the inner wire is defended by Western NATO troops with state-of-the-art training, state-of-the-art equipment. The outer wire is defended by Afghan soldiers, 18, 19 years old, weapons the Soviets left behind. And so immediately you are presented with this hierarchy of whose lives are worth more than others. And this was, you know, in a context where everybody's supposed to be on the same side, there was still this very real hierarchy in place. That's the sort of stuff that influenced me when I was writing the book, more so than the sort of strategic or logistical or bang-bang aspect of war. It was much more the idea of seeing the systemic ranking of human beings and imposition of a kind of asymmetry that influenced the writing of the novel.
So this might sound like an odd question, given what you said about having a very romantic idea of what a war correspondent was and then being quickly disabused of those notions. But did you enjoy being a war correspondent?
Generally speaking, I spent 10 years as a journalist, and during that time, I covered everything. I was a business reporter for a while. I was a technology reporter. I went to Gitmo. I was in Ferguson during the Black Lives Matter movement. I covered a lot of climate change. And generally speaking, I mean, when you're doing the job the way you want, it's the best feeling in the world. You feel like you're changing the world for the better just by telling the truth, which again is sort of, you know, some people might take as a naive way of looking at the profession. I fully understand that, but it doesn't change the fact that that's how I felt when I was doing the work I wanted to do. that correlated very strongly with telling stories that had I not told them, they were unlikely to be told. So when you're in a place like Kandahar, I remember doing this story on polio vaccinations, which heavily influenced a scene in American War, and thinking at the time, you know, there aren't 40 other reporters doing this. And that gave me a sense of at least some usefulness as a professional. Where the job felt worse was when I felt like I was rewriting press releases. And I didn't feel that way when I was covering war.
Is there a way in which writing fiction, writing novels, is also telling the truth?
I would hope so. I mean, I was left with all of these residual experiences that I couldn't make sense of in the context of journalism. I mean, journalism at its core is very much based on answers. If you don't have answers to who, what, where, when, how, you don't have a piece of journalism. But I was left with all of these questions, and fiction is where I go to sit with those questions. There's very little of the prescriptive in any of the novels or short stories I write. And so for me, it's a chance to just sit with these things and not feel like I'm obligated to do something to wrap it all up and provide a direction.
How did you make that transition from being a journalist to writing fiction? I mean, it is a common fantasy among those in the profession.
I remember when I sent American War to an agent who subsequently became my agent, but we had met 8 years earlier just randomly. And I sent her a note saying something like, you know, I know it's every literary agent's worst nightmare when a journalist says, I have a novel for you, but I have a novel for you. And she was very kind. Fiction has been my first home for a long time. I got a story in the student paper when I was very young, and it was the first time I felt a sense of being anchored. We talked earlier about this idea that I, you know, have moved around a lot in my life. And for folks like me who don't have a very good answer to the question, where are you from? The idea of being able to step into a made-up world and move those contours around to fit your experiences was very appealing. I was writing fiction all through my time at the Globe and Mail as a journalist. I wrote 3 novels before American War during that time. There's a literary term for them, terrible. And so I decided never to, I haven't shown them to anybody other than my best friend. I never tried to get them published. And I was going to do the same with American War. It was just going to sit on my hard drive. And then I had a bad day at work. I had one of those days where you feel like you're just rewriting press releases, and I thought, to hell with it. And so I sent the book out and got very, very lucky.
So this novel, What Strange Paradise, is not one of those 3 from the bottom drawer.
God, no, no. If you ever see those, it means I've become so famous that they're trying to cash in. No, no. This is recently written.
All right. Tell us what it's about, because I think people will recognize some of the themes you've touched on already.
It opens on a migrant shipwreck on an unnamed and somewhat fantastical Western island. There's a 9-year-old child named Amir, who's the sole survivor of the shipwreck. And as soon as he opens his eyes, he is spotted by the local authorities, who try to detain him. And he runs off into a nearby forest, runs into this teenage girl named Vanna, who decides to hide him, to shelter him from the authorities and try to get him to safety. And from those scenes, from those opening scenes, the book alternates, split into before and after chapters. The after chapters chronicle everything that happens once the boy arrives at the island, and the before chapters show you how he got there, the journey across the Mediterranean, and how he ended up in this place. It's a reinterpretation, I suppose, of Peter Pan. It's a story of Peter Pan retold as the story of a contemporary child refugee. And it's a much shorter, quieter book than American War, but thematically for me, it feels like it comes from a similar place.
It's interesting because our reviewer called it a fairy tale, which Peter Pan isn't quite, but you can see the similarities in tone. Do you see it that way, as a kind of fairy tale?
Yeah, I mean, there's this thing Borges once said about how all literature is tricks, and no matter how clever your tricks are, they eventually get discovered. My tricks are not particularly clever. I lean very hard on inversion. And I wanted to take a comforting story that Westerners have been telling their kids for the last 100 years, and I wanted to invert it to tell a different kind of story. And so that aspect of the fable, of the fantastical, runs through a lot of the book, particularly the second half, the island in which that part of the story takes place. I remember getting the line edits back from the copy editors, and there were all these notes saying, are these real birds? I looked them up on Google. I couldn't find them. Is this real? Are these real trees? Are they, and it's because I made up the flora and fauna of this place. I wanted that aspect to the book because I think at its core, it's a book about dueling fantasies. The fantasies of people who want to come to the West because they think it's a cure for all ills, and the fantasies of people who exist in the West and think of those people as barbarians at the gate. The book takes place at the collision of those two fantasies, and I wanted to write it that way.
So that's interesting, given that you made up the birds and the flora and fauna of this particular island. What was the research then like? I mean, did you actually go to Greece to look at what an island like this would be and then fictionalize it?
It's been a long time since I've been able to go back. The island is very much based on Crete, and there's some very obtuse clues to that throughout the book. A lot of the location is based on my experiences going back, both as a journalist and also as someone who grew up in Egypt. Almost everything that happens in Alexandria at the early part of the before chapters are things that I've repurposed from my experiences, both growing up in Egypt until I was five, but then also when we lived in the Middle East, we would go back quite often. So like almost everything else I write, it's a sort of smorgasbord of various experiences repurposed.
In very different ways, refugees figure in both American War and in this novel. What drew you to write about the Syrian refugee crisis?
So one of the prompting incidents or events or memories, I guess, that got me to thinking about the things that would eventually become What Strange Paradise was in 2012. I was on assignment back in Egypt, and I was driving around town with an old high school friend of mine who was complaining about pretty much the most universal thing that you can complain about, which is rent. You know, rent had gone up, and he was angry about it. And at one point I asked, so what's the rent for an apartment in your building, for example? And he said, well, do you mean the locals' price or do you mean the Syrians' price? I said, well, what the hell's the Syrians' price? And he said, well, we've had an influx of refugees, and they don't have much choice. So you can charge them upwards of, you know, three times as much. It quickly became apparent that this wasn't just a rent thing. This was, you know, you go down to buy fruits and vegetables from the stall and you'll get the same treatment. And this was also in the context of all the Arab leaders talking about our Syrian brothers and sisters, and we must support our Syrian brothers and sisters the same way for decades they've been talking about our Palestinian brothers and sisters and how we must support them. And it was all nonsense. At the end of the day, there was a population that could be exploited, and so it was going to be exploited. And so that shaped my thinking about how necessary a component that is of almost every modern society, that there be this load-bearing beam of human beings who can be exploited with no consequence. Again, American War is not how I think a literal Second Civil War would go down. What Strange Paradise is not a literal interpretation of the migrant journey, but they're very much influenced by this idea of who you can safely exploit and whose misery you can safely look away from.
So that incident occurred in 2012. And presumably that's when you were also either writing American War or before you read American War. Do you just kind of tuck that away in your mind and then at some point after you're done with that first book, go back and revisit that idea and start writing a new novel?
Yes. The very unorganized attic that is my brain works that way. I mean, it was 10 years, I think, or something like that, between watching that clip on that news network and starting to write American War. It's usually many, many years of just thinking about a thing in the most amorphous way possible before I sit down and try to border it, try to sort of pen it in the form of a story. Recently, I was rereading a section of American War, and I saw something in it that, for the first time, struck me as being very similar to a short story I wrote when I was 18 years old. It was an exchange between two characters that I had repurposed in the novel and had not realized I'd repurposed it until 15 years later, I guess, or something like that. That is generally how these things happen in my head.
So do you know what that thing is from the attic of your brain that is going to inspire the next book that you write, or are you already working on it?
I have a page and a half. It's been a while since I looked at that page and a half. I suspect when I look at it, it'll turn into a page because I'll delete a good chunk of it. I'm in the very early stages of thinking about something. But the last thing I'm going to do is commit to any idea on the New York Times Books podcast, because then I'll be held to account. So I'm going to keep quiet on that.
Well, we'll have you back and you can tell us then if that page and a half ended up being your next novel. You've already given unreasonable hopes to many aspiring novelist journalists out there in this conversation. Omar, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Omar El-Akkad's new novel is called What Strange Paradise, and it's his follow-up to his debut, American War.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Tina Jordan joins us now to help celebrate the 125th anniversary of the New York Times Book Review. Hey, Tina.
Hey, Pamela. Today, I'm going to bring you one of my all-time favorite stories. It's from 1914, and the headline is Stupidity of Clerks, a Bar to Book Sales. And here's how the story goes.
I'm like nervous, but go on.
The blank-faced book salesman who by his incompetent innocence of the contents of the books he handles blocks sales and disgusts would-be buyers among the reading public, a topic which came up for serious consideration by most of the speakers at the 14th annual convention of the American Booksellers Association at the Hotel Astor yesterday. The prevailing opinion seemed to be that a policy educating the bookselling clerk to a degree that would make possible a closer and more profitable connection between booksellers and readers should be adopted. It was even suggested that a nationwide correspondence school to teach the right principles of bookselling be established. And I will just close by saying, by the end of the convention, they had discarded this idea and decided that, in fact, the positions were ideal for college girls who are having trouble getting jobs elsewhere.
So what year was this?
1914.
Got it. And then the problem went away.
And, well, did it?
Let's hope. All right, Tina, thank you.
Thanks, Pamela.
My colleagues Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong both join us now. Their new book is called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Hi, Pamela.
And congratulations. The book is a New York Times bestseller. You are both reporters at the Times, but in different bureaus at the Times. Cecilia, you're based in Washington, and Shira, you're in the San Francisco Bureau. So I have not met either of you. Before we talk about the book, I'd love for you to each tell us a little bit about the work you do at the Times and a little bit of what your trajectory in journalism has been. And let's start with Cecilia.
You know, we actually love this question because we wrote this bicoastally. I am, as you said, based in Washington, and I've been covering technology and regulatory policy for quite some time. I was at the Washington Post before I came to the Times in 2015. And what the beat has essentially amounted to over the last several years is accountability and how the government is trying to come up with regulations over the technology industry and particularly the biggest tech companies.
And Shira?
I joined the New York Times 4 years ago to cover cybersecurity, and it was interesting. It was kind of a natural progression out here in the San Francisco office that misinformation and disinformation and sort of our online ecosystems really became part of my coverage. We very quickly decided that cybersecurity wasn't just traditional hacks, but more broadly, what were we seeing online? Of course, the 2016 elections and everything happened during those elections played a role. But, you know, Cecilia and I had a largely online relationship during the beginning of our partnership because I was in San Francisco, she was in New York. Our coverage naturally intersected and we became interested in similar things.
So how did the project come to be? Were you two co-writing stories together on technology, or was this your first collaborative experience?
We were co-writing lots of stories because, in fact, we were finding that the technology companies were right at the intersection of security, like Shira said, misinformation and disinformation in particular, and regulatory oversight and scrutiny and politics, really at the intersection of politics as well. So we wrote a story in November 2018 with other Times colleagues. The headline of that story was Delay, Deny, and Deflect. And it took readers inside Facebook over a very tumultuous period where the company was grappling with Russian interference on the site and privacy abuses with the story of Cambridge Analytica. And what we did was we took readers into the decision-making process within Facebook, really up close to the leadership. And what we found is that story generated so much interest. The public really responded to that story because Facebook has done such a good job of protecting its image and presenting itself as a particular kind of company. And we really lifted the veil and showed a very different side of Facebook. And I think that was what the readership of the New York Times and the general public was really thirsting for, to really understand this incredibly powerful company over our society and over our exchange of ideas.
So how does it work then to go from writing these stories together, and obviously you cover some of this ground in the book, to then switching over to a book? And did you continue to report on this while working on the book? How does that get divided up?
It was always a bit of a juggling act. You know, we both were reporting daily almost for the New York Times, and this was an ever-evolving story, especially during the 2020 elections. We saw things very much changing in real time. It was interesting, though, because so much of what was left in our notebooks at the end of the day was just perfect for the book. The things that you can't say in an article, really just because of space constraints, about what the room felt like, what people were wearing, the multiple perspectives on a single meeting, we just don't have space for it in a 1200 or 1300 word article. And so we were able to finally take all those things left in our notebooks and put it towards this book and go much deeper with many of the sources. We oftentimes would go back to the same source two or three times that we had spoken to for an article just to get more nuance on what they had originally said.
All right. I want to ask a question of each of you before we start talking specifically about the content of the book. And that is, do you remember your first personal and or professional encounter with Facebook?
I remember two things really well. I joined Facebook in 2006 and I loved it. I was just such a prolific poster. I was just obnoxiously prolific about my postings. I was really interested in posting about my newborns at the time and, you know, keeping up with other people.
And it's so funny to look back at those early days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've completely changed. I'm still on all three apps because I have to as a reporter, but I'm really careful about what I do because I think hard about the consequences of every single stroke, every single hovering of my mouse, what it means and how the machine operates behind the scenes of Facebook's business when I make those decisions. And then my first interview with Mark Zuckerberg was in 2010 over a huge privacy gaffe when Facebook made millions of profile settings public. And interestingly, that was the first time that I'd heard him say, "We're wrong. I apologize," essentially. And it's a pattern that would repeat itself.
It's on the back of your book, actually, your book cover, these alternating statements from Mark Zuckerberg and from Sheryl Sandberg. "We never meant to upset you. I ask for forgiveness and I will work to do better. We made mistakes." What about you? When was your first encounter, Shira?
Well, you know, I'm 1 year older than Mark Zuckerberg. And so, and then I happened to go to school in Boston. And so I really vividly remember the Facebook coming online because I was one of those college students that was among the first to join. All my friends were joining. And I remember that moment of being in I think I was in my early 20s and feeling like, wow, what an amazing tool. I can find that cute boy that's in my class, and I can find that high school friend that I've lost touch with. And back then, I don't know if people remember, but they prompted you to give statements on it.
Like what you were busy doing.
Yes. Yes. Like I'm walking to my whatever history class, or I had pizza for dinner. And I think back on that time of that regularly updating it with the really mundanities of my life. And I can see how exciting it was in that moment to finally have a tool that connected people. It was interesting in reporting this book and going back and interviewing people who worked at Facebook at that time, because the way I was using it was so exciting to them. The fact that I, along with, you know, millions of other American college students, was logging on every day and seeking out what my friends were saying. It really was a brand new technology and a really incredible way to connect to one another. And at the time, I myself didn't realize how much data I was feeding into Facebook systems about my own life. I was not aware of what they were collecting about me and just how nuanced a picture of my life they were able to build with things that I freely offered up.
Did you also interview Zuckerberg?
I did not. Cecilia has been reporting on technology much longer than I have. I was actually a Middle East correspondent for 10 years. And so I only came back to the United States and really to cover Facebook in 2015. My earliest interaction with Mark Zuckerberg was when I was working on a story about Myanmar and the introduction of the internet there. And I'd gone to Facebook for a meeting. They were releasing some new product and he was there, and I tried to get a question in about Myanmar and failed. And I was told very clearly that Mark Zuckerberg was a product person and that he was focused on new products at the company, and that I needed to direct my questions to Sheryl Sandberg on the policy side of the company.
Well, since you've brought up Myanmar, let's just talk about that briefly. How much did Facebook actually know about the way they were being used in Myanmar?
I mean, I think for us in this book, the Myanmar chapter is one of the most powerful because it shows people repeatedly warning them about hate speech in the country. They have not once, not twice, but a dozen times people raising up their hands from within the country and without and saying, hey, you have a huge problem here. Hate speech is getting out of control. And as we show in our book, we have a scene where an individual goes to Facebook's own offices and says in plain English, you know, if you don't do something, it is likely that a genocide is going to happen. And so they were certainly warned again and again. And I think one of the astounding details is that at the time, Facebook only had one Burmese speaking content moderator, an individual who wasn't even in that country. And this is a place I should mention where over 100 languages are spoken. And so they weren't getting any visibility into what people were posting in Myanmar. They had, you know, they had lots of people warning them and saying this is bad. And even then, they didn't hire more content moderators to try and help them understand what was happening on the platform.
So this is obviously not the only instance in which misinformation and propaganda and hate speech and inciting violence has taken place on Facebook's platform. There's obviously the Russian disinformation during the 2016 American presidential election, things that went on in terms of Brexit, now going on with COVID, and obviously with the January 6th Capitol riots. What is Facebook's basic position on all of this? They're not a publisher. They don't regulate content. They stand for free speech. Does that kind of summarize it?
Yeah, I think all of the above, and it's still evolving. And what I mean by that is what we really show in the book is that in particularly over the last few years, so many problems have surfaced that were embedded and designed into the technology and the business model. And what I mean by that is the business model of Facebook is to get you to engage so that you feed more data into Facebook. And Facebook then turns over that data to advertisers to target ads. And linked to that is a technology that wants and needs for you to engage as much as possible. It wants your attention. And what we found is over and over again, that design, which is a feature, not a bug, has led to all these things that have happened. I think Facebook's position is that they're trying and that they are a platform, a technology. They certainly say they're not a media company, and they have a really interesting position on speech. And Mark Zuckerberg outlined this at Georgetown University in 2019, when he talked about Facebook being sort of a different kind of entity, like a fifth estate is how he described it. And he said that we understand our power as a platform for speech that reaches 3.4 billion people around the world. But we also believe that good speech will always conquer bad speech, in that if there's more speech, that lies by politicians, harmful rhetoric, incitement of violence, particularly by the former president, that the public will fact check him. And so we're just going to let all the speech exist. And what we'll see is naturally a weeding out of the bad. And what they've found is that that's not quite right, especially when you have algorithms that amplify the most emotive speech, which often is rancorous speech and misinformation. And so we've seen an evolution of Mark Zuckerberg's position. I mean, as we all know, Facebook has temporarily banned the former President Trump from the site. So I would say that they're really just figuring it out. And we show in this book that a lot of people think that a company like this, that's so sophisticated, that has so many people who have coming with like such incredible pedigrees, that they have a plan in mind. They're actually, in many cases, doing this on the fly. They're making a lot of ad hoc decisions. And ultimately, most of those decisions in the recent years have been made by Mark Zuckerberg.
How is it that they can make the argument that they are not a publisher?
That's an argument that they started making very early on. Mark Zuckerberg, I think, personally found that to be a very attractive argument because he said, well, we're not making decisions about what people see. I think people who study the platform would argue that that's not entirely true because ultimately Facebook does have an algorithm which ranks things. And so it decides what you see in what order in the newsfeed. And that same algorithm also pushes you into groups. It makes assumptions. It says, well, if you like this one thing, maybe you'll like this other thing. And so it is making decisions every single day that impact the lives of Americans. You know, I think that there needs to be a new terminology for discussing Facebook because it is not a publisher in the traditional sense, but it's also not a neutral platform in the way that Mark Zuckerberg and others have really, you know, claimed up until now.
In former President Barack Obama's most recent memoir, he suggested that among his regrets from his presidency was not regulating big tech more. Did the Obama administration miss out on an opportunity to regulate Facebook earlier?
I think it's undeniable. During the Obama administration, some of the most consequential mergers by big tech companies occurred. In the case of Facebook, that was Facebook's acquisition of Instagram in 2012 and Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp in 2014. Also during that time, data privacy regulations never took hold, even though there were dozens of proposals. And during that time also, big tech companies were generally praised by politicians. And there was an incredibly close relationship between the Obama administration and big tech executives. And so I think what's happening is, in retrospect, you're even seeing people during that time, including President Obama, say that there's a lot of regret. And right now, very interestingly, you're seeing the Biden administration try to course correct. There is a sea change right now in Washington. And many of the same people actually that were making decisions back then are saying, we made a mistake. We're going to correct this.
So that leads naturally to the latest news from the Biden administration in naming Jonathan Kanter. Can you talk a little bit about who he is and what this might signal in terms of future regulation of Facebook?
Jonathan Kanter has been a big tech critic and particularly a critic of Google. And he has also represented, interestingly, clients that have gone up against Google, media industry, for example. And he was appointed to a position at the DOJ to lead the antitrust division there. He's essentially the top antitrust cop right now in the nation, along with Lina Khan, who is leading the FTC. President Biden has also named Tim Wu, who is a really well-known scholar and has advocated publicly for the breakup of big tech companies, in particular Facebook. I mean, I'm actually astonished by these picks. I've been covering this for a long time, and the message is so clear. This is not a middle-of-the-road, center-democratic approach. This is a very progressive agenda. This is straight from like the Elizabeth Warren camp of breakup big tech. So I think you can expect a lot of action going forward. That said, I think it's really important, and we show this in the book, Facebook has been very sophisticated about building its Washington influence operation and its lobbying operation. They are the biggest lobbying operation of any company. They've far surpassed big oil, big pharma in terms of how much they spend and how many lobbyists they employ. So you can see that there's going to be a real fight over any real legislative or regulatory reforms.
All right, we've talked a little bit about Mark Zuckerberg, and we need to talk about Sheryl Sandberg. There was an excerpt from your book, very, very juicy and fascinating, about the relationship between the two of them. I'm interested in your take on Sandberg and how much a role she's played, Because she has really, like Facebook, which we thought was kind of this very innocent, fun thing back in the day, the public perception of her has shifted, it seems, enormously since she came to most people's attention as this feminist icon with her book Lean In and her Lean In circles, and then Tragic Widow when her husband suddenly died. And now she comes across more as a very bottom line, soulless operative. How accurate are these descriptions of her? Who is she?
I think she's a nuanced person. I think anyone that tries to define her with one extreme or another is going to run into problems. I mean, fundamentally, she is the person, the architect of Facebook's business strategy, which has been hugely successful. And she has overseen a lot of their policy decisions, which have been quite controversial. One thing we wanted to show in our book was the relationship between her and Mark Zuckerberg and how it started off as really both of them fulfilling for the other something they deeply needed. Mark Zuckerberg didn't want to deal with the business side of the company, the policy side of the company. Employees liked to joke that he was allergic to Washington, D.C. And Sheryl was deeply interested in doing all of those things. But, you know, as we show in the book, as time goes on and as the Trump administration challenges Facebook over and over again, they run into problems and their relationship runs into problems.
How big a threat is regulation coming from outside the United States, from the EU, for example?
Oh, yeah. There's so much activity happening, not just in the EU, but globally, in Australia, in parts of Asia, even in Latin America. The EU right now is considering an update of competition policy, as well as taxing, all kinds of different legislative proposals there. There is so much global interest in regulating big tech companies for their power and dominance, but also on very specific things. And I think what the EU is doing that particularly scares big tech companies and particularly Facebook is that they're taking a hard look at the business model. You're hearing a lot of rhetoric coming from European leaders that behavioral advertising is a big part of the problem and that too much data with any company such as Facebook or Google has led to so many problems in terms of competition across the economy. So they're sort of the most experimental, if you will. They're willing to do things that are far more aggressive and than you're seeing in the US by far.
All right. There's so much more that you address in your book, and I can't get to all of it, but I do want to ask one more question about the future of Facebook. And that is that for years, people have been saying the kids don't use Facebook. Facebook is old school. It's a bunch of baby boomers, maybe some Gen Xers on there. And it's true that it doesn't seem that kids today, and I'm talking about millennials and teenagers and younger, don't even use Instagram, which of course is part of Facebook, but they've moved on. They're on TikTok, they're on Snapchat. Why has Facebook not declined inevitably as a result of this new generation moving away from it?
Well, as you noted, you know, kids may not be posting on it as often, but most of them still have accounts on Instagram, WhatsApp, and even Facebook. And so even though they're not using it in that same daily obsessive way as we see them using newer apps like TikTok, for example, they're still on there. And we have to remember that that decline in popularity and growth is really happening here in the United States and in parts of Europe. But in the rest of the world, Facebook is still hugely popular. I mean, if you go to this day to India, to the Philippines, you will hear people talking about Facebook as if it's the internet, and it's young people, old people, it's really everyone. It's become almost a utility in many of these countries. And so we can't underestimate how much growth they're seeing in those other markets.
All right. There is so much more I want to ask you, but I know that you're both also busily continuing to report on what's going on with Facebook and with all of these regulatory battles. So thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang are authors of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination, which just hit the New York Times bestseller list. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela. So one bright spot in the publishing industry for, let's say, the past decade or so has been audio, especially digital audio. It's been this tremendous boon to the industry. Sales have been growing by double digits for 9 years now. And it hasn't cannibalized print. So publishers are really seizing on this territory. And one interesting development that's been happening for a few years, but is adjacent to what you think of as the core business of publishing, is the arrival of audio originals. These are audiobooks without the book. So they're standalone works of audio. It's kind of interesting to see increasingly a lot of big name authors are experimenting with this format. So you have novelists like Margaret Atwood and James Patterson and Curtis Sittenfeld who have done original works for Audible, the audio producer and retailer that's owned by Amazon. And on the nonfiction side, you have writers like Michael Lewis, Michael Pollan, Ada Calhoun, who've also struck these deals with Audible to release their works first in audio. Sometimes there's a print counterpart later on. Sometimes it just lives in the audio space. So now we're seeing some big publishers starting to consider the potential for audio as its own genre without a print counterpart. And this week, Penguin Random House Audio announced that they are doing Eric Larson's next, I want to say book, but it's a standalone piece of audio. His next project is his first audio original. It's also his first work of fiction. It's coming out in September, and it's called No One Goes Alone. So this is really Eric Larson, who, of course, is well known as a historical nonfiction writer, branching out into new territory in multiple ways. This is a project he's been working on for more than a decade, and it's a very spooky one. It's timed to Halloween. It looks at the ghost hunting exploits of the psychologist and philosopher William James, who was a very avid seeker in terms of spirituality, but he was also interested in the occult. And so when Eric Larson was researching James for a project he was working on, another book, he became curious about James's belief in ghosts and created this spooky story where James and some of his colleagues go to a haunted house on an island, and their plan is to study what these occurrences could be coming from. And of course, it takes a very deadly and surprising turn into the supernatural. So something very different for Eric Larson, and also something quite different for Penguin Random House Audio, to see a major publisher releasing a work in audio, not only first, but exclusively, is interesting, because I think the general consensus among publishers until now has been the more formats you have a book out in, the better. You're often dependent on that print edition being in stores as kind of a advertisement for the audiobook. So when you don't have the print edition and you don't have people seeing it in the usual places, how are they going to discover it? It does help to have an author with a pretty avid fan base like Eric Larson. But it's interesting to think that audio is being separated out and treated as its own genre, its own format, not just as a kind of appendage of print. And certainly it's one of the most profitable formats right now for publishers. We saw last year, you know, during the pandemic, I think there was a concern that audio would fade a little bit because people weren't commuting. That's one of the main ways that people tend to listen to audiobooks. And I think that happened a little bit in the early months of the pandemic, but it absolutely bounced back, and publishers released a record number of audio titles last year, more than 71,000, an increase of nearly 40% over the previous year. And revenue for downloaded audiobooks grew more than 18% in the first 5 months of this year. So it's still growing substantially.
Are you a big audiobook listener?
You know, I listen to podcasts, including our own, and I do listen to some audiobooks, but I tend to read books that aren't out yet, galleys, because I'm looking ahead and thinking about what I'll be covering. And there aren't that many audiobook galleys that I have encountered yet. And sometimes I have to say, particularly if I'm reading fiction, I like to have it in my own head and not described to me, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues MJ Franklin and Emily Aiken. Hey, guys.
Thank you for having us.
MJ, let's start with you. What have you been reading?
I have been reading How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. It's a look at race in America, and specifically the stories and myths and tales we tell about race in America. Clint went to 7 spots in the U.S. and 1 spot abroad that deal with race, that grapples with our history of slavery. And he kind of looks at, like, what's the history there? How are these places reckoning with their past? a lot of these places are like plantations that have told the story of like, oh, this is where like Jefferson lived. And now they're adding the story of slavery and the impact of slavery on Black Americans. And so he's kind of like examining those stories, talking to some of the curators of these places and seeing what they have to say about this kind of expanded history that we're talking about. Pamela, I know that you've talked to Clint on the podcast, and so I don't want to speak too much about just the concrete makeup of the book. I do want to say that what I'm feeling as a reader, which is that this book connects the dots in a way that is so fulfilling and rewarding. And a lot of these dots are just in our faces. And because of how we talk about history, you don't connect them. So a prime example for me is towards the end of the book, Clint writes in a pretty short sentence, he just says, some of the people who threw stones at Martin Luther King Jr. are still voting in today's election, which I logically know. But what that sentence does is it collapses the history. We tend to think of like what happened with Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights era in the 60s as completely separate from the world that we're living now. And that sentence, so short and so quickly, says, actually, they're not separate eras. What happened then is still comes to bear on what's happening now. And it's all swirled into one.
I find that collapsing of history fascinating. I also thought the very kaleidoscopic approach that he takes of coming at this from so many angles, because he could have just gone to plantation after plantation. But I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you thought about the Confederate Cemetery chapter.
I really loved that chapter too, because like, again, you meet new characters. And I feel like in a lot of the chapters, he's talking to curators of museums or these tour guides. But in the Confederate Cemetery chapter, he's talking to several people about their family history. And it's so personal. I think in that chapter, he's talking to one person and he sees someone else listening in on them. And so he positions himself so that person's in too. And it makes his accounting of this history so deeply personal. And I think in that chapter, people push back on him too and offer their versions of this history and specifically the Lost Cause narrative. And it's interesting watching him think about how do I introduce this expanded version of history to these people? Because not everyone's primed to hear this history. There are personal stakes. And I think that's what that chapter gets at. And I think just overall, that chapter illustrates just the strength of the book, which is how fantastic of a guide Clint is throughout all of this history. He's coming at it personally, as a historian, as a critic. And so the book is so densely packed with information, but it never feels like an information overload, because he, as a person who's navigating this too, is just with you, the reader, 1,000% of the time. I'm really, really enjoying it. Emily, I know that you read this book too. Do you have any thoughts about how the word is passed?
I would just add only that it's not only a very personal book, it's a very intimate book to read. He's very personable. And one of the remarkable things he's able to do is strike up conversations with people at all of these sites that he visits. And I think what's one of the other remarkable things about the book is how much restraint he demonstrates. It's really sort of a listening tour, although he does have interactions with people and struggle with what to say when someone actually gives him a bit of misinformation, historical misinformation. But he encounters a lot of incredible ignorance about American history with admirable restraint. He's listening. What do people really know? And for some people, many more than you would expect, the idea that Jefferson was a slaveholder is shocking and a revelation. And so the fact that he's able to listen to all these different voices he encounters, the book is not animated by fury, by an agenda, but really kind of a desire to know what kind of conversations are happening out there and what people are missing.
I 1,000% agree. And there's one chapter where he talks about New York, and that's another myth that we have, that like somehow New York, part of the North, was not implicated in the American slave trade. And it was. And as a reader in New York, it's kind of like turning the mirror on all of us. It's such a fantastic book. I feel like I could talk about it all day. But I know, Emily, you also had a book that you've been reading. I wanted to throw it over to you.
Okay, yes, I've been reading a very different kind of book. The book I want to talk about is Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath by Heather Clark. This is a new biography of Plath, and it is riveting. I say that word with some trepidation because this book is also more than 1,000 pages, but it is exceptionally well written and utterly engrossing. And I can already anticipate the objections. First of all, there have been several biographies of Plath, including a couple of psychopathographies. And Clark deals with this in her introduction. She talks about the cult of death around Sylvia Plath, the way her life has been overshadowed by her suicide and how she's become a kind of a caricature, her poetry reduced to symptoms of madness. And of course, Plath killed herself at the age of 30 in 1963. How could she possibly merit a 1,000-page biography? But Clark, who I think is a professor of poetry at a university in England, she makes mincemeat of these objections. Her close readings of Plath's poetry make clear just how incredibly rich and varied her verse was. She went through this tremendous evolution as a poet. I think we remember her for the Ariel poems, her posthumous collection, those inflamed, furious, fantastic verses. But she actually went through a number of styles and formal poetry before she got there in her very short career. And that's what Clark is really interested in. She wants to restore Plath to what she believes is her rightful place in American letters as a major, major writer. And I think she succeeds. And I guess this would be my final pitch for the book. This book is, believe it or not, a page turner. I have never read a biography in which the subject becomes so alive on the page. And I think part of that is Plath's voice is all over the book. She was just so prolific. She wrote poetry and she wrote a brilliant autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar, but she kept calendars and diaries and wrote hundreds of letters. And she had this intense preternaturally verbal personality. So whoever she met, she made a huge impression on. And almost everyone she met wrote a kind of remembrance of her or in interviews with Clark talked about their impressions. And Clark herself is an obsessive. There is no pebble, stone, boulder that she left unturned. I mean, I think there are two pages on Plath's first words as a baby. So you get everything in this book, and yet it is a page turner. I mean, this is a book about a woman of huge literary talent and ambition, you know, who believed that making art was a sacred calling. And at the same time, it's a portrait of those middle decades of the 20th century in which she lived. And the combination is just sort of dazzling. And now, Pamela, I know you also are reading a biography.
Well, I recently finished the Lenin biography that I talked about on a previous episode when I was about halfway through, and that is Lenin, the Man, the Dictator, and the Master of Terror by Victor Sebestyen. And this was a book that came out in 2017, and Sebestyen was a guest on the podcast. So I have finished the book. When I last talked about it, I was, you know, about halfway through, but he had not yet taken power. And the feeling I was left with at that point is that it felt kind of astonishing that not only did he become the dictator of the Soviet Union, established the Soviet Union, but that he then went on to influence this communist regime in the Soviet Union for decades to come. Because the feeling you get as you're reading the first half is like, I can't believe it was this guy. He just was, unlike the Plath biography, not someone who seemed to be necessarily of great talent. Certainly, yes, ambition, but his ambition was not particularly successful for a long period of time. And what I focused on the first time was the fact that I didn't quite have a full understanding of him as a person. It's not a psychobiography. It's very much focused on the events of his life and, to a lesser extent, some of the relationships. It's more a political biography, I would say, than a kind of full portrait of him as a human being. But there are these bits and pieces that give you some color. And in the last time I talked about his feelings around art and music and literature, and related to that, I wanted to quote a passage in here that is about books as well, but also really shows a little bit what kind of person he was. I'm going to read from an anecdote about his policy on libraries. When Lenin wasn't chairing meetings, he was furiously writing these decrees, many of which read as though they had been dashed off with little thought. Others were merely exercises in propaganda, not government, as one of Lenin's old comrades charged with implementing them admitted. From the start, the decrees showed two characteristic aspects of his rule that stood out: a dictatorial tone and the way Lenin could be sidetracked by small things. The man who often thought in a grand historical sweep and believed he was starting a world revolution could be obsessed by trivia. For example, when it was touch and go whether his revolution would survive, food stocks were running out in Petrograd and Russia was still at war, he spent hours on a subject close to his heart, but still a matter that could have been handled by a mid-level official. He wrote in his spindly hand a decree on libraries. Its hectoring tone was typical. 1. The public library, formerly the Imperial Library, must immediately arrange the exchange of books with all the libraries in Petrograd and the provinces, and also with foreign libraries, Finland, Sweden, etc. 2. No charge must be made for sending books from one library to another. 3. The reading room in the library must be open every day, not excluding Sunday and holidays, from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. And it goes on from there. I mean, it's kind of astonishing the level of detail. And this is when he is running the Soviet Union. It's kind of impossible to imagine, I don't know, President Biden, for example, or any other world leader with getting into the nitty-gritty about library policy. But that was very important to Lenin. He had spent enormous portions of his exile, in particular, working in public libraries.
Interesting. May I ask a question? What made you pick up this book? Whenever I hear someone's reading a biography, I always wonder, especially if it's a world leader or just really any big biography, I'm like, what got you interested in this person at this point in time?
Well, I'm always interested in terrible people. I have gone and visited all three of the pickled dictators of the 20th century. I've been to Lenin's tomb and Mao's tomb and Ho Chi Minh's tomb. And I think it's hard to visit that tomb, and especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, and see the extent to which not just tourists are going there, but, you know, average Russians are going there too, the hold that he has on the public imagination. I have to say, this book really whet my appetite for a biography of Stalin. So anyone has any recommendations on that front, that might be where I go next. All right. I don't think I've persuaded you necessarily to pick up this biography, MJ, but let's run down the books that you are reading right now.
I'm reading How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith.
I'm reading Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath by Heather Clark.
And I read Lenin, The Man, The Dictator, and The Master of Terror by Victor Sebastian. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.